Good morning. Good morning. Welcome to Bellmead United Methodist Church. I'm Sam McLaughlin, and I'm the senior pastor here. If we haven't met, I would love the chance to get to know you. Gracie mentioned the yellow visitor card in the pew rack in front of you, and we would love for you to fill that out, and we have a gift for you for being here today. If you're online or listening to our sermon podcast, we want to say welcome to you as well. You're an important part of our community. During the season of Lent, which remember are these 40 days when we are walking very closely with Jesus through his life and ministry and death and resurrection, we have given you these opportunities for spiritual growth. And I want to remind you that on Wednesday nights, we come together for a meal between 5 and 6 o'clock, and then we have a midweek Lent service here in the sanctuary at 6:15. I love these services because we get to hear a lot of different voices. Lay people in the pews are coming and sharing their reflections on these I am statements of Jesus that we are using on Sunday. And so coming up this week is Jan Miller, who will be our guest speaker. And then we also have guest musicians that are a part of our church. So Deborah Gordon will be leading us in music. If you're somebody who watches online, you can also find us live streaming on that night. During the season of Lent, our sermon series is The Way, the Truth, the Life, as we are looking at who God is and who this great I am is. Naturally, we needed to start back in Exodus chapter 3 when God calls Moses to go and lead the people out of Egypt, out of slavery. And Moses says to God, in sort of this last piece of the passage we read, he says, God, if people ask me who sent me, what should I tell them? And God says, well, I am who I am. So you tell them that I am has sent you to rescue them. Right? I started to think this week about that phrase, I am who I am. Sometimes in our lives, we run up against people who say that as a way of saying, I'm not going to change, right? Like, I have done the same thing for decades and decades, and you may want me to try to do differently, but I am who I am. Like, you deal with it, right? And sometimes that can be frustrating or annoying to us, just depending on our situation. But here in this moment in the Bible, when God says, I am who I am, God is saying, I will be who I've always been, and I'm not going to change. And that is a positive for us, right? I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I am the God of your ancestors. I am the God who made faithful promises to you in the past and kept them. I am the God who has made a way in your life when you saw no way. Now here, as Jesus starts to bring up these I am statements, he's connecting himself to God, and he's also broadening our understanding of who God is, like giving us different metaphors, different ways of seeing. And so today we're looking at this first statement, I am the light of the world. Now the book of John, the Gospel of John, talks about Jesus as the light in many different ways, but we're looking at two places where Jesus says to the people listening to him, I am the light of the world. Now, the first story we didn't include in our passage, our text for today, because I'm just going to tell it to you. But the second one comes from John chapter 9. So the first one in John chapter 8 goes like this. It says, at dawn, Jesus went to the temple courts where the people were gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. I have no idea what this really looked like, but I kind of imagine like a bunch of preschoolers coming to the rug for reading time and sitting down on the floor and the teacher getting down their level, like getting down with them. And it says, in the middle of his teaching, these other religious leaders and teachers brought in a woman that was caught in adultery. Now, it says that they made her stand before the group, right? So they're putting her on display. And they turn to Jesus and they say, teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. Moses says that we should stone her. What do you say? Now, this isn't out of concern or care for her. This is a way for them to trap Jesus. They don't really like the way that he's talking about these teachings and ways of belief. And it says, without speaking, like Jesus says nothing, he begins to write on the ground with his finger. Right? They kept questioning him, and Jesus is down here like a child playing in the sand, looking at the ground, playing with the dirt with his finger, until finally he stood up and he looked at them and he said, "Let any of you who is without sin throw the first stone." And then it says Jesus got back down on the dirt and kept playing in the dirt with his finger. And so one by one, these people started to walk away, just like drop their stones and leave. And when he finally stood up and he looked, all he saw was the woman. And he said to her, "Where have these people gone? Has anybody condemned you?" And she said, "Not one." And Jesus says, "Well, neither do I condemn you, but go now and leave your life of sin." Now, right after this story is the verse that we read out of chapter 8 today. It's when Jesus turns to the people that he's teaching and he says, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." Now, the second time he says it comes right after this story in chapter 9. It's the one that we read today. Jesus was walking along. He saw a man who was blind from birth, and his disciples asked him a question that reflected the theological understanding of that day. They say, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that made him to be born blind?" Now, Jesus takes a minute to correct this theology. He says, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned," right? Disconnecting that from his blindness. Then he says, "This happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him." Now, does this mean that God caused this man to be blind so that one day God could display God's works? That isn't my understanding of God. I think this means that whatever condition we find ourselves in, nothing is impossible for God. God is able to bring God's work out of whatever condition we find ourselves in. Now, the next thing he says, "As long as it is day, we must do the works of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work." By night, he means his hour of death. "While I'm in the world, I am the light of the world." So, you know, scholars have kind of gone back and forth on this "we" that's put into the text when there are all these other personal pronouns. But this is a good argument for leaving this "we." Last week we talked about how God came to Moses and said, "I have heard the cries of my people. I have seen their suffering and I have come to deliver them and bring them up. But I want you to be the one to go to Pharaoh and convince them to let them be free." We have this divine human entanglement, right? Liberation in God's eyes is a joint endeavor. And so, when he leaves, we become the light of the world. Now, after saying this, Jesus goes back down to the dirt. But this time he picks up some dirt and he spits in it. How lovely. And he mixes it up and he rubs it on the man's eyes. And he tells him to go and walk, go wash in the pool of Siloam. And after washing, after coming out of the water, this man is able to see. Now, the people who thought they recognized who he was, you know, someone who was blind before, are amazed. And they ask him, "How were your eyes opened?" And the man said, "Jesus," right? Tell me, church, has Jesus opened your eyes? Is there a time in your life someone could say, how have your eyes been opened? And your response is, "Jesus." Now, I think one of the natural questions that come up when we look at this passage is, why did Jesus spend his time playing in the dirt, or, you know, or pick up dirt and spit in his hand? I'd really like to know why, right? There's a couple of reasons that we can do guesswork on. The healing power of clay that was mixed with spit was a popular element of healing stories in the Greco-Roman world. So as Jesus often does, he uses things that the people might be able to draw on in their everyday life. But of course, he sort of turns it on its head a little bit. If they are reading or hearing these stories about the power of clay mixed with spit in doing the same thing, but making a man able to see, he is saying, look at what God can do with this. Now, another reason he might have done this was because it was a Sabbath day, and there were 39 categories that were explicitly forbidden on the Sabbath. Healing was not supposed to happen on the Sabbath, but also kneading things together was not supposed to happen on the Sabbath. So as he's picking up that dirt and he's making mud and he's kneading it together, he is maybe trying to push these Pharisees beyond what they know, right? Like, we believe this theology where sin must be connected to his blindness. We believe this theology where healing cannot happen or kneading cannot happen on the Sabbath. But Jesus is pushing us beyond that understanding and calling us into something different. And so we could say that in mixing this mud, Jesus is helping them to see differently. Think about how the old rules or old order might be hindering the opportunity for the miraculous. And we know, church, that it can be hard to see differently when we have seen a certain way for a really long time. I've heard someone else interpret this as maybe in using this element of dirt and dust, Jesus is calling attention to our humanity. Right? Like, we have this origin story that says God made us out of the dust and breathed us into being. And in making us in the image of God, we have this divinity within us, but we are still human. We are but dust. We are still frail, still capable of making mistakes, still in need of grace for our sins. And so maybe in drawing in the dirt, he created this illustrated reminder to people trying to stone a woman to death that she is human, right? Maybe in gathering dirt and spitting in it, it was a reminder to his disciples trying to marry sin and illness that this blind man is a human. And our beliefs, our rules, our religion cannot remove a person from their humanity, or we have failed to see Jesus. Our beliefs, our rules, our religion, they cannot do psychological or spiritual or physical harm, or we have failed to see Jesus. There are many ways that we can talk about the light and its functions, but perhaps in this story, Jesus, as the light of the world, is asking us to expose that darkness within us, right? Inviting us to drop those stones and take a good look at ourselves in the mirror. Perhaps the light can function like a flashlight that scans the corners of our own hearts and helps us to see our criticisms, our judgments, our missed steps, our beliefs that could cause harm, but not with the intent of shaming us, right? Here, as the people bring this woman before the crowd and make her stand there, they are trying to shame her. But Jesus refuses to allow her to be shamed. And so, this is really important when we talk about who I am is, who God really is. Some of us have learned different concepts of God, different ideologies, and I think it's important to say God is not a shaming God. Like, from the very beginning of time, it says that God created us out of that dirt, breathed us into being, called us good, and the two people that were created for one another were naked, vulnerable, and without shame. Somehow, we have to, in the church, disconnect looking at our sin and casting shame upon ourselves. The intent is not for us to turn and start stoning ourselves, but to understand the work of shame in our lives and begin to heal it. Okay, so when we talk about looking at our own sin, or we talk about shame, or we talk about guilt, what do we mean by that? This week, I've been looking at a book called Shame and Grace by Lewis Smedes. He was a writer from 1921 to 2002. And he was an author, an ethicist, a professor, a theologian. And in his book, he starts to define sort of this difference between guilt and shame. He says, we feel guilty for what we do, but we feel shame for what we are, right? Guilt is, I did something bad. Shame is, I am bad. This way that we take on a certain identity. Guilt is not always a bad thing, right? An action or a behavior that doesn't line up with who we are or who we want to be can convict us. And it can invite us to be aware of ourselves and create change. Shame is this state of being that we live in, that we can't move out of, that says we're undeserving of love. And so in his book, he writes about, the title of the chapter is called Leading Candidates for Shame. And he's kind of giving different sketches of people and the way that shame manifests in our lives. And so here are the things that he describes. He says, there are some people who are guilt spreaders. Guilt becomes a stagnant shame after it flows from one thing we did over all the things that we are. He says, in this way, the shame equation is one wrong act equals one bad person, right? Like one speeding ticket and you're a horrible driver. One lie and you're a liar. One act of infidelity and you're a cheater, right? How do we stop taking on shame identities from one act? How do we stop projecting shame identities onto others because of one act? Another group he talks about is the overly responsible. And I thought, well, that doesn't sound bad. You know, I'm a pretty responsible person. But he says the overly responsible feel as if they, not God, have the whole world in their hands. Right? And so everything that goes bad in the lives of other people around them is somehow their responsibility. And if they cannot fix it, then they are inadequate or unworthy. Right? These are people who see the pain of the world and they're ashamed that they can't do more to heal its wounds. They sort of take it on. This becomes a form of shame. He talks about obsessive moralizers. He says these are people who see life in moral colors, as if everything is only right or wrong. Nothing can only be just fun or just delicious or just exciting. They can't just simply taste life. They have to measure it and weigh it and evaluate it to see whether it's morally sound. And so when these people do anything that's like slightly outlandish, they feel like they have a moral deficiency. Another group he talks about is the never deserving. People who cannot enjoy the good gifts of life because they feel they don't deserve those gifts. He says, though, any healthy person, and I would say any spiritual person, knows that the gifts that we have in our lives are gifts from God, right? We know that we did not earn them, and in that sense, we don't deserve them. But part of our task is to gratefully accept them, to share them with other people. And so when people leap from feeling undeserving to feeling unworthy altogether of anything good, that is ripe for shame. The next group he talks about are people condemned by bad memories. You know, something that we have done that we cannot let go of, that we sort of replay in our mind's eye and our hearts over and over again, like feeling that piercing shame, unable to get off of that loop. He talks about a time in his own life when he failed to speak up in a moment of racial injustice, right? Or maybe we think about a time that we have hurt a loved one or a loved one has hurt us. I paused here to think about this because I think this is something that really plagues a lot of us. And several years ago, I came across a line in a book that I don't think, you know, by itself is very grand, but it says, in our lives, we can choose integration of our whole life or despair. You know, and I just found that to be true in my life. I have to find a narrative I can live with. I have to find a way to integrate the things that I have done or things that people have done to me, or the alternative is despair. You know, maybe in his case, he would say shame. He talked about people who dwell in the shadow of their parents. He talked about people who can't approve of themselves unless other people approve of them. You know, people have to like me, admire me, say nice things about me, and then I feel acceptable. You know, like we're putting that that power into someone else's hands. He says that actually often these people's parents are stand-in for God. So if mom and dad don't approve of me, then God must not approve of me. And that disapproval becomes this shadow of shame over a child's life. That feels really important for those of us that are raising kids or grandkids. Then he talks about the last one, compulsive comparers. You know, does anybody compare themselves to anybody else ever? You know, some people feel shame they don't deserve because they're forever comparing themselves to someone else, mostly to people who are more successful, however that's defined for them, than they are. So every time their friends succeed, they feel like a failure. Anyone else's beauty is the reflection in which they see their own plainness. You know, like if that person is extraordinary, I must be incredibly ordinary. And so if this moment with Jesus is this invitation to look at ourselves, right? To see what's reflected back in the mirror, then what do we see when we look, right? Do we see ourselves taking on the weight of the world, like just as heavy as this bowl of stones? Do we see ourselves obsessing over every little thing, putting them into moral categories? Do we feel never deserving and worthy of love? Are we plagued by bad memories? Are we looking for other people's approval? Are we compulsively comparing ourselves to others? Where can the light of the world eradicate this shadow of shame that we see? You know, I kept wondering in this passage what it was like for the woman in that moment when Jesus told her that she wasn't condemned, did tell her to go and think about her sin and change her life, right? But like, did he get on her level? Was she on the ground? Was she standing up? Did he get on her level? I just want to believe that he looked her straight in the eyes and said, you are not condemned, right? Go and live differently, but feel accepted. Understand my grace. Feel it in your bones. I don't know with the blind man if Jesus is the first person that he saw or not, but I want to believe that he was. That after he washed his face, maybe Jesus walked him to the pool. Maybe he was standing there with him. Maybe he helped him to wash his eyes. I just want to believe that when he saw somebody for the first time, he was looking in the face of Jesus. He was looking into the eyes of grace. And so, church, what if we could look in the mirror and we could see Jesus reflected back to us? We could see ourselves the way that he sees us. We could see our divinity, our humanity, our worth, our blessed belovedness, a life, a person who does not have to live in shame. Thanks be to God. Amen.